With the highly anticipated release of the film Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice, which is hitting theaters nationwide, NPR pop culture correspondent and author of Superman, the unauthorized biography, Glenn Weldon gives us the backstory of the infamous Dark Knight in his new book, The Caped Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Glenn Weldon to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about your interest in Batman, and after you write a book about Superman, is it inevitable that you will write about Batman?
Well, inevitably, yes. A lot of people kind of come to this topic and they think to themselves what I thought to myself, which is that, okay, so if Superman is the light, then Batman must be the dark. In the Superman, the Unauthorized Biography, I basically came to the conclusion that Superman is a mirror to us as we want to be seen by the world, a very flattering mirror. He's incredibly powerful, but he uses his power always with restraint. He's always looking out for the little guy. So I went into it, like a lot of people, I think, do, then thinking, well, okay, so if he's a flattering mirror, then Batman must be a dark mirror, right? He must be all those stuff that we don't want to admit to ourselves.
Right.
Rage that we feel when we get cut off in traffic or these feelings of isolation and aloneness, but that misses something very important about him. Batman isn't about revenge. He's not about getting back at the people who murdered his parents. He dedicates himself to this very optimistic, wildly optimistic notion of never again. What happened to me is not going to happen to anybody else because I'm not going to let it. And that is what's really beneath the violence, the grimness, the grittiness. That is a species of hope. Now, it's a weird hope. It's a very doomed hope. It's a very Sisyphean kind of hope because, you know, he won't be able to do what he's dedicating himself to do. But it's a selfless act. Not a selfish one, not revenge.
So one of the things, that, as you point out in the book, and we'll get into this in a moment, that everyone has their version of Batman. So for many of us, as we look with the new film coming out, Batman vs. Superman, of why the two are opposing each other, because they are both good guys, right?
Yeah, but this is kind of the nerd lingua franca. Ever since there were superheroes, there were people kind of wondering, especially in the 60s, when superheroes went from being bland, iconic cops in capes to actually having discernible personalities, as soon as you give a character a personality, you put them in conflict with somebody else. And that's what nerds do in the back of comic book shops. We debate whose butt could get kicked by whom. And we compare their powers, and we talk about this endlessly, and we cite chapter and verse with the Talmudic intensity. And so, yes, all what happens in all of these stories is that two heroes meet, they mistake each other for a villain, or there is some kind of elaborate ruse that is putting them in conflict. By the end of the movie, by the end of the comic, they will realize that they've been duped, and they will join forces to defeat the duper. That's just the formula.
And we like the formula.
It's familiar. It's iconic. We keep coming back to it. And, you know, again, this is a fiction writing 101. You define your character by putting him in conflict with somebody else. You tell us, by putting them in conflict, what they're against, which is almost as important as what they're for.
Give us a little bit of the origin story of Batman, how he came to the pages of comic books in 1939.
Well, he was a ripoff of the Shadow, and he was one of many. He wasn't even only the only bat-themed ripoff of the Shadow. There were two other guys who swanned about rooftops back then with a bat costume or something very like it, because the Shadow was very popular. The Shadow was essentially the first multimedia sensation, radio, comics, pulp novels. He was also meant to be a replacement Superman. Superman had come out the year before, and the publisher went to Bob Kane and said, give me another Superman. So Bob Kane came up with this idea for a Batman, but he didn't have it. He had a guy in red long johns with a big sort of bulky winged apparatus on his back. He went to his friend and colleague Bill Finger. Bill Finger said, well, if you're calling him Batman, he's got to look completely different. You can't be wearing red. You can't have a little domino mask. You need to give him big pointy ears because that's what bats have. He's got to have a scalloped cape that you can make look dramatic. So basically everything we know about Batman today came from Bill Finger, not Bob Kane. And for about a year, he was a dark, grim vigilante, and he did, like the Shadow, he killed a lot of folks. In the first 11 months, he killed 24 men, two vampires, a brace of werewolves. I don't know what you call the collective noun for werewolves. I guess a pack of werewolves.
Yes.
And two giant mutants. But that worried his publishers. His publishers decided that the country wouldn't have this rising up against comic books until about 10, 15 years later, when suddenly there was a crackdown and parents and church groups got very upset. But they sensed that it was too violent for young kids, so they introduced Robin, the boy wonder. And when they did that, Batman goes from being a lone vigilante to basically a father figure. And that completes the story, because Batman by himself is only half the story. You need Robin.
Although you point out in the book that there is a history of adding and removing Robin as our attitudes towards different social issues come and go.
Yeah, well, there's a cycle here. Batman cycles from light to dark and then back to light, inevitably. And he also cycles about every 30 years through being a lone vigilante to being then a father figure.
They may be drinkers, Robin, but they're also human beings.
And then the leader of an extended pack of sort of bat-themed proteges. And then once that gets to be too much, they send everybody off and he becomes a lone vigilante again.
If you're working alone, wear a mask.
I'm not afraid to be seen standing up to these guys.
The mask's not for you. It's to protect the people you care about.
It's a cycle, it repeats, and it's part of his makeup.
What was the state of the Batman franchise and the Batman comic when the Adam West 1960s show came about?
In the late 50s, Frederick Wortham, who was the psychiatrist I mentioned before, who led this anti-comics crusade, basically noticed what he considered some homoerotic themes in Batman and Robin comics, and that led to a proliferation of exactly what I said before, a bunch of bat-themed proteges. There was a Batwoman, a Batgirl, a Batape, a Batdog, because he wanted to surround these two guys with plenty of chaperones, basically, just to kind of take any kind of unintended homoerotic meanings out of the text. But superheroes at this time were basically cops in capes. They didn't have definable personalities. But the comics were popular, not necessarily with kids, but with hipsters of the time, because the pop art movement was flowering in the middle of the 60s, and the pop art movement valued things that were slick, commercial, colorful, mass-produced, like comic books. So the makers of the Batman television show noticed this, and that's how they formed the show. They said, we will take these comic books and we will just cut and paste these comic books onto the television screen. A lot of people think they were making fun of the comics or making fun of Batman. What they were doing, essentially, was saying, let's take all these conceits that are in this comic and just play them absolutely straight. And that is where the source of the show's humor came from, and that is why it became a multimedia sensation and a huge fad.
Some days you just can't get rid of a bomb.
But the nerds who were reading Batman comic books at the time hated the television show. And once the fad faded, DC was looking around for something to do because Batman's sales numbers kind of dwindled, and they needed to remake him. And that's how we got the Batman that we know today.
So one of the things that's fascinating about the 60s TV show is, as you say, it was a fad. And it didn't last very long. I mean, I remember growing up hearing the stories about how this was a show and all the big names in Hollywood wanted to be on the show and so forth. But it really only lasted, a year and a half?
Essentially, yeah. It was actually three seasons jammed into almost 2 years. And, of course, for those first two seasons, there were two episodes a week, which meant that we had just a heck of a lot of episodes. It lived on in syndication for pretty much ever. That's once you got that many episodes produced, you could just keep running them and running them and running them. That was actually how I came to the series in the 70s when I was a kid. It was on television every afternoon. And before I ever picked up a comic, I knew who Batman was because of that television series.
And do you feel that you did know who Batman was? You knew that Batman, but perhaps you didn't know the Batman, right?
Yeah, because something was going on in comic books at the time. They wanted to get as far away from the Batman of the television show as possible. So they created, essentially, his exact opposite. Everything we know about Batman today was created, really, in 1970 when Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams came along and said, we're going to make a Batman not for kids, because they noticed that kids weren't reading comics much anymore. Now the core audience base of comics were teens and adults who were demanding something a little bit more complicated and, yes, darker than the Pow Zap comics of the mid-60s. So that's what they did. But for a long time there was the television series and things like the Super Friends, which perpetuated the idea of this sunny, careful, chum, pedestrian safety Batman for many years. But that was the one that the mass culture saw on television over and over again. But in the comics, which were read only by a few thousand people, there was this very dark, gritty, grim, swoonily gothic Batman. Much different, and there was a disconnect there for a long time.
I'm Batman.
When you look at the 1980s and then the films, the Batman films, begun by Tim Burton, that was trying to get us back to a serious Batman, right?
Yeah, well, see, what came in 1985, a guy by the name of Frank Miller decided he would tell a story about a Batman at the end of his career. And he was doing that very intentionally, not to serve the nerds, because he kind of knew the nerds were already in his back pocket. They were going to read this thing because it had Batman in it, regardless. He was aiming that book, which was called The Dark Knight Returns, squarely at normals, outside the walls of this enclave that nerds had kind of walled themselves inside. Because what he was engaging with that comic was not the character of Batman as he existed in the comics, but the idea of Batman as he existed in the greater culture. So the power of that book came from the fact that he was basically saying, what would happen if the Adam West Batman came back today, older, much older, and out of shape, and had to realize that his old methods didn't work anymore? And that's the power of that book. And that book inspired, along with another book called The Killing Joke, that inspired the Tim Burton Batman film. And anytime you take the character of Batman out of the comics, no matter how you do it, you change him, because all of a sudden he's not this character that exists in perpetuity, just constantly, endlessly iterating in the pages of a comic. You have to give him a beginning, middle, and an end. You have to give him that thing which comic book characters, like soap opera characters, are explicitly denied, which is an ending, a story. It's the difference between an adventure and a story that we're talking about here. And so, you know, you get, in the 1989 Batman film, you get a Batman who, spoiler alert, has his parents killed by the Joker, because that has a tidy action movie logic, you know, the Chekhov's gun of the action movie, where the thing that happens in the first reel has to pay off in the third. But that is explicitly the wrong thing to do with Batman, because, again, Batman is dedicated to fighting crime. The thing that sets him off on his crusade is not wanting to get back at the guy who killed his parents, but at crime itself. It's a Tim Burton film. I try to argue in the book that it's not a true Batman film.
Without that, would we have what we have now in this current Batman that we've seen in the Christopher Nolan films?
Well, it all has its roots in the Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams Batman of 1970. Everything comes from that. The success of that film is part because it was kind of tuned to the zeitgeist, in large part because of the merchandising. That film changed how films were marketed and changed how films were merchandised forever. That bat symbol, if you were around in 1989, you could not avoid it. It was all over the place. I was in Greenwich Village at the time, and it was basically everywhere on every human being, stamped like a tattoo. It was inescapable. It was a cultural phenomenon, like the 1966 Batmania fad was before. But like I say, you take Batman, who is a character who exists to put himself out there, and you give him a very tidy sort of revenge story, where he has the three-act structure with a love interest who finds out a secret identity. You actually have him in that film kill a couple folks, which is, you know, a huge slap in the face to what superheroes are. Superheroes are not action movie heroes. When an action movie hero kills the bad guy at the end of the story, it's cathartic. We've come to expect it. It's tidy. It means that the threat is over. But if Batman kills the bad guy, then why does he still have the cape? You have to explain it some way. And the way that Tim Burton explained it was that he explicitly said, well, he's nuts. So that kind of robs him of agency. That kind of robs him of having a story he can kind of get behind. So it was a compromise, but it was a necessary one because you can't take a character who just exists to exist in perpetuity on a comic book page and put him into an action movie. It's always going to be a rough fit.
It seems as though Tim Burton wasn't, like, thrilled with this once he got into it, right? Is that safe to say?
Yeah. He found it incredibly exhausting emotionally and physically because there was so much interference from the studio. The studio, Warners, had a lot invested in this, and they interfered a lot, especially in that first film. They kind of backed off in the second film, which Batman Returns seems more like a Tim Burton film as we've come to expect it. It's a little darker. It's kind of emo. It's a little kinky. It's all his typical Tim Burton-esque kind of flares. But the first film, they had a screenwriter who knew that you can't make the Joker the guy who kills Batman's parents, but that's what the studio wanted. The studio said, no, this is tidy. This really puts a button on the film at the end. Because, again, there are nerds and there are normals. Nerds love adventure. We pick up a comic, we know that it's tied to 77 years of history. We know that there's been retcons and reboots, and this backstory is incredibly complicated, and we love teasing it out. Normals say, give me the bullet points. Walk me through it.
So you assume, just as an average fan, that if you're watching these films, and first it's Michael Keaton, then it's Val Kilmer, and then it's George Clooney.
I'm Batman.
You assume, right, that's not a great role, or they didn't have fun, or they would have come back, because there was money there, right?
There was money there. George Clooney sort of lost interest. Val Kilmer had a conflict, and yeah, I mean, they're certainly, and those last two films, the Joel Schumacher films, made lots of money. They came in way under budget, and they came in before, like, not just on time, but weeks ahead of schedule. Warners was delighted with them. It's the nerds that hated them and launched letter-writing campaigns, and this is at the start of the Internet as we know it today, and went online and created entire web pages devoted to trying to get Joel Schumacher out of the director's chair. They ultimately succeeded, but that had a lot to do with other things that were going on in Hollywood at the time and other things that were going on in Schumacher's life at the time. But, yeah, this is the rise of nerd culture. This is because what nerds do is we say, not this. You're doing it wrong. And, my favorite thing about nerds is our enthusiasm. It is unironic, and it is infectious, and it says to people, I found this thing that I love, I want to share it. The problem is that it very easily curdles into vitriol, into hoarding, saying, this thing that I love is mine, and you do not love it for precisely the same reasons and to the same extent that I do, therefore you're doing it wrong. So it's a knife's edge that we live on today between that unbridled passion and this toxic, sometimes homophobic, sometimes misogynist vitriol.
I'm Batman.
It does seem, as you say, it's very divided, but there was somewhat of a consensus, for purists anyway, that the Christopher Nolan films were successful and went back to the true roots of Batman.
Speaking of which, you know how I got these scars?
No, but I know how you got these.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to remember those true roots really came along in 1970. Yes, he was a dark vigilante for about 11 months, but for most of those preceding 30 years, he was just a happy-go-lucky guy, a cop in a cape. Again, Warners learned a lot about marketing a film from the Schumacher debacle. They knew that they couldn't have the director and the cast come along and do the talk show circuit and sort of make fun of the concept and say, yeah, I'm not crazy about it, or I don't really know the character. They briefed them within an inch of their life so that these cast members, the producers, the director, could go and sit down with a room full of comics journalists. And by the way, that's another thing that happened in the intervening years. We had comics journalists now. And sit down and cite chapter and verse of which comics these storylines that they were talking about were borrowed from. That was something that made nerds feel protective of these films in a very basic way, because they felt to nerds like they understood the character, that they understood the motivation, such that they would get very protective of it. And when critics would say something that was not even a pan, but just like a mild critique, the critics would get descended upon by nerd hordes, because all of a sudden, instead of taking pot shots at Hollywood, as they had for the Burton films and the Schumacher films, they were inside the tent, pointing their guns out.
So now, Batman comes in the guise of Ben Affleck, and the nerds are mad.
Well, I mean, I think you're going to find that Zack Snyder's version of Batman is a lot of the hardcore fan base, specifically the fanboys, their version of Batman. He is a badass. He is grim and gritty.
But they were upset at the beginning, right? When Ben Affleck was named Batman, there was a lot of grumbling.
Yes. Well, that's inevitable. That's what we do. There's a whole thing in the book about every time a new Batman is announced, there is, even before there's a real internet to kind of to work up into a frothing nerd rage, that we just managed to do so in the pages of fanzines, something like that. My issue was that it was basically the same costume as Daredevil, which he played back in the 90s, and he looked silly then, and I figured he would look silly in this getup. He kind of does, but, you know, my issue with this film, and I haven't seen it yet, but my issue with the trailers and the pre-release marketing that I've seen is this is by the guy who turned Superman into a dark, gritty character in Man of Steel, and that's just a fundamental misread of who that character is. So, you know, I live in hope, but I sublease in Please Don't Suck.
Nipples seem to be a big deal for the nerds on Batman costumes.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Schumacher did. I mean, Schumacher didn't quite understand the term comic book. He used to go around telling his crew, they're called comic books, not tragic books. Make it fun. Make it sexy. And that translated into turning these costumes, which were, beforehand, they were kind of body conscious, but they were basically Kevlar suits, into Greek statuary, which meant throwing on some nipples onto it. It is the thing that when I did some research for this book and went back to the old fan sites, boy, you can just do a search for the word Batman and nipple and you will find frothing nerd rage of many different varieties.
And meanwhile, and I hope it wasn't lost what you just said a moment ago, which is, so meanwhile, before we go out and we see the movie, hope springs eternal that the movie doesn't suck.
Yeah, that's always the thing. I mean, it's going to do well. It's been engineered to do well. It will make its money and then some. Is it going to be any good? Is the question. And because this is going to be inside baseball for a lot of your listeners, I expect. But in the 90s, something happened to comics, superhero comics. They became very extreme. People felt that the old heroes of the old days were too old-fashioned and safe, so they made heroes, and they kind of interpreted heroes to be more violent, and everything became a spectacle, everything became a splash page, and we lost storytelling to spectacle. I have a feeling this is a 90s comic brought to life with all of that entails.
Well, the new book is The Cape Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Glenn Weldon, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Caped Crusade. Glenn Weldon is the author. It's published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Could this mean curtains? Will the identities of our dynamic duo be revealed to the whole world? Is this the end of their career as crime fighters? Can they avert disaster? Answers tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel.